Hi, this is Paul, and in preparation and anticipation for the conference that is coming up in May in Chino, California, where myself, Jonathan Peugeot, John Vervaeke, Catherine Wilson, and John Van Donk are going to meet, I'm going to be making some videos about the quest for a spiritual home. This one's going to be some orientation, probably, as I still continue to do it. We'll go deeper and deeper. Before the conference itself, in April, the five of us are going to have an online conversation in order to sort of continue the conversation that we began in Thunder Bay on consciousness and conscience, and also to begin to lay some groundwork, hopefully so we can sort of find each other and figure out what we're going to talk about and how we're going to lead the conversation that develops in Chino. So I thought I would get a few things started and just put some basic cards on the table. Often when I think about something like a quest for a spiritual home, the YouTube song, "I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For," sort of rings in my ears. There are some very deep biblical themes about this. Looking for a land of rest, looking for rest, Sabbath, shalom. Genesis 1 is sort of a temple text where there's this construction of the world, which is a temple. And then, of course, in six days, God builds the temple, and on the seventh day, he rests. And that rest is an active inauguration. It's not simply a cessation of labor. It's the beginning of an enjoyment. It's much more of a fulfillment. In Exodus, you have that sense of the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey, and they are living in the desert, they are traveling through the desert, they are enduring in the desert, they are even, in fact, dying in the wilderness in order to get to that land, to inhabit that land, and the question as to the degree to which they actually find rest in that land, well, that's in many ways a big topic of the conversation in the Bible. Zion, God's holy mountain, is also the temple on Mount Zion. There's another image of rest, of the world as it should be. Of course, the tabernacle was sort of a movable temple, but all of the furnishings in the tabernacle were there to design and show that this is a place of creation as it should be. Creation, don't know how to say it well. We'll continue to try to figure out how to say it. New Jerusalem in the New Testament, obviously, new heavens and new earth. John Walton talks about this rest as an inauguration of creation's intended goodness. The book of Ecclesiastes, he has placed eternity in our hearts. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a book where there's this longing because there's a sense that the teacher goes to and fro throughout creation looking for goodness. Is it in labor? Is it in pleasure? Is it in achievement? Is it in all of these things? And there's very much a restless spirit, and that placing eternity in our hearts in some ways means that there is a space, there is a messenger from beyond and above us that won't let us rest as long as we have not achieved, arrived, found this spiritual home. The book of Hebrews, I think, really gets at it well. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking for a city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children, because she considered him faithful who had made the promise. And so from this one man, he, as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had an opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You have all of that sense of longing, and these tensions have been, they've been acted, they've been worked on, they've been worked through, they've been embodied throughout the history of the Christian church. And many religions are, in fact, analogous in this, in that they can be expressions of humanity's striving for a spiritual home. Now, one of the things that we're going to bump into, and it's going to be an interesting topic in this conversation, we'll get into, when we have this ongoing conversation with John Vervaeke about a two worlds mythology. And I think we have a sense of what John is talking about and a sense of his critique of that. Yet, you know, part of my contention is that we don't tend to escape this. And when John gets into the second self or the sacred self or the imaginal self, John had a very interesting conversation with a scholar, I believe, from Harvard Divinity School. And so John, in that sense, works this, I don't want to say duality because it's going to trigger a whole bunch of other things, but works this tension between now and not yet. Between as I am and the potential of what I can be and was that what I should be. In other words, place here is not merely a metaphor for location, although we don't want to take that away. As with almost everything in these kinds of conversations, the categories are larger than a lot of the either-or choices we have to make as we begin to try to seek clarity and instantiation of these things that we're seeking. Now there's tremendous tensions within not only the history of Christianity, but the history of Christianity between Judaism. Jacob has colonized a sufficient part of my consciousness, Congress, that, you know, when I talk to Jacob, for example, about his eschatological imaginations, you know, he and I often go back and forth with respect to a Messiah. Okay, what is a Messiah? Well, I'll know the Messiah when I look up and I see, for example, and I hope I'm being fair to Jacob in this, when I see, let's say, the heavenly temple come down upon the Temple Mount. And Jacob, of course, has his own vision of how this goes and where this goes. This very much came up in a conversation that I did with Aaron of the Morning Show and Nate Heil when Aaron wanted to talk about hell. And whereas we did do some talking about hell in that, as with even this conversation, we're going to talk about to what degree can this desire be fulfilled and satisfied here and now, and whether that satisfaction and fulfillment that can be had in the here and now is sufficiently instantiated in the here and now. Does it matter that it can't last, for example? There are moments when, in a sense, we taste eternity and that the moment is timeless, but we still You look into the old Jim Croce song, "If I Could Put Time in a Bottle." It's that longing that we have. It's that eternity in our heart. It's what Hebrews is talking about in all of this. And then that brings into the question of the now and the not yet. Of, is it a two-world mythology? Does it come now? Can it come later? And these are not small issues, and they're not issues that should be sort of taken lightly. They're very much issues even within Christian eschatology of the now and the not yet. And of course, when I say things like that, Jacob usually pushes back. And, you know, John Vervaeke's going to have his take on a lot of this. And Jonathan Peugeot, of course, too. So these are some of the things that I wouldn't be surprised if they come up in the conversation. A big element of this is this very tricky word, spiritual. you know, a contemporary lexicography of the word. For many people, spiritual is just sort of a feeling. Spiritual things are feeling things. Other people see spiritual as immaterial. For some people, spiritual is very high in terms of their rank order and their hierarchy. Spiritual things are good things. Spiritual is sort of the unseen that moves and controls and directs. It can have a sense of goodness or authority. Spiritual is a very difficult world to sort of get at. And those of you who've been following my channel for a long time know that this is, you know, we talk about school spirit. We talk about, a big part of my channel has been an attempt to find language that helps people have a higher resolution, a little bit more clarity on what we mean by this word in order to have better conversations with respect to it, hopefully, which will enable them to be better sojourners on their quest for a spiritual home. Now, when I think of spiritual home, this is one of the favorite pictures that I have in my rather large collection of pictures that I've taken in Yosemite National Park. This is the Ahwahnee Lodge in Yosemite Valley. And when I see this picture, the lodge is just beautiful architecture. And the setting is one of my favorite places on earth. And you can just, you know, it might be Lothlorien, it might be Rivendell, it might be all of these sort of places. And as you can see, the quest for a spiritual home has within it the sense of place. But it's not merely a place. It's all of these other ideas that we've been talking about. It's the land of milk and honey. It's the promised land. It's a land of rest. It's what our hearts have always desired. You know, for many, looking for a spiritual home is a colloquial equivalent of a place of rest. Eternal is a word that comes, and eternal can be both timeless, but also has a sense of free from decay, free from corruption. And this is, I think, the kind of home our hearts desire. It's a rather unusual thing for our hearts desire. And, you know, I think, you know, I get into my upper and lower register, because whereas all we know in the lower register is decay and change, there's something in the upper register that is sort of timeless and enduring. And of course, very quickly, ideas and arguments drift over to Plato. And of course, in this conversation, we'll be talking about Neoplatonism, we'll be talking about heaven, we'll be talking about spiritual immateriality. C.S. Lewis very famously said, "All loves in this world will end in betrayal or death, but love is not subject to that." And so you get into this question of decay and non-decay. And then again, once you get into that question, you'll get into questions of, to what degree can you, then even we struggle with the words, participate in this, achieve this, arrive at this, possess this, or be possessed by this. C.S. Lewis's argument from desire comes to mind. I had ChatGPT write this out. Now, I feel a little bad using ChatGPT because it's taking this from how many other sources on the internet and not leaving any footnotes, which I think is, you know, to some, you won't even get away with this in a high school paper, but ChatGPT is getting away with it. But here it is. C.S. Lewis's argument from desire is an argument for the existence of God based on human nature and desire. Lewis argues that all human beings have a deep longing or desire for something beyond what this world can offer. He suggests that this desire cannot be fully satisfied by anything in this world, and that it points to the existence of a transcendent reality or ultimate fulfillment. Lewis argues that this desire is not simply a desire for pleasure or happiness, but rather a desire for something that cannot be fully described or defined. And so you see, when we say a spiritual home, we have a placeholder in for something that we can't fully describe or define. He suggests that this desire is not caused by any external influence, but is inherent in human nature. Lewis believes that the only explanation for this desire is the existence of a transcendent reality, which he identifies as God. He argues that if God did not exist, then this desire would be inexplicable and meaningless. Therefore, the existence of this desire provides evidence of the existence of God. Overall, Lewis's argument from desire suggests that human nature and desire provide evidence for the existence of a transcendent reality or ultimate fulfillment, which he identifies as God. Now, ChatGPT, that second paragraph is a little redundant, but I kept it in for ultimate fulfillment because there's another couple of words that have the sense of that which we seek. And we have a sense that that which we seek is timeless and not subject to decay. Now, this is a quest for a spiritual home, and it's important for you to know that the five of us came up with this theme together as we talked about what we wanted to do. The word quest in that phone call, it's not published or recorded, but when we were putting together, part of what John Vervaeke noted was, you know, the background of the word quest. The word quest comes from the old French word quest or quest, which means a search or pursuit. This word in turn derives from the Latin word, I don't know how to say that, but you can read it here, which means to seek or to search for. Actually, I had a dream last night that I had the opportunity to take Latin in some school. The word quest was originally used in the context of a religious pilgrimage or a journey undertaken in search of something, such as the Holy Grail or a sacred relic. Over time, it came to be used more broadly to refer to any kind of search or pursuit, whether it be a quest for knowledge, adventure, or personal growth. Today, the word quest is often used to describe a long or difficult journey, either literal or metaphorical, undertaken in pursuit of a goal or objective. It can also be used to refer to a personal mission or a sense of purpose or direction in life. This picture here is one that I took when we were having some estuary, kind of a trial estuary breakout session. And for me, this is in many ways what a quest like this really looks like. And as we plan the conference, we're going to make sure that this isn't just sitting and looking at the back of other people's heads and seeing talking people on the stage sharing whatever wisdom they might have. But there will be plenty of turning towards one another, and not just having to, hopefully, this is what the Estuary Protocol is all about, not just hopefully having to endure what one rather gabby member of your little breakout group is deciding to unload on everyone, but in fact to get everyone a chance to speak and to listen. Because in terms of what we do in an estuary meeting, listening is actually far more important than the speaking part. And so we will be together, and more than virtually, not alone. For those of you who follow the Grim Grizz channel, we are not passive in this. No quester is passive. As with any journey, the outcome is not purely within our control. And that leads to a sense of anticipation, excitement, maybe a little bit of anxiety and fear as well. It's not something we merely possess, but to become the possession of a much larger, better, stronger, I would say more blessed lover. And in many ways, that is what we are, I believe, looking to become the beloved. So this is the quest for a spiritual home, and I just wanted to make a little video to sort of set a table. I don't know that John or Jonathan will do anything of this. I know John is, of course, John's after Socrates continues to roll out, and Jonathan continues to do what he did, but for this channel, I wanted to continue to talk about some things, and I hope to do some more videos on this. And so if there are aspects of this that this video has sort of provoked in your mind, put them in the comment section, and maybe I will pick them up for topics of subsequent videos, and this can go on into the, at least the shaping of my presentation and what I have to contribute to this overall quest together. So, as always, leave a comment.